The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
What's the understanding in the rank and file of how you're supposed to do your job? And how important do they think it is to operate in a framework of intelligence under law and to follow the rules even where it's a nuisance or where it may be limited? For them? Do they have a regular practice of consulting with their lawyers? You know, do they just sort of look to the bosses, and what tone at the top are the bosses setting for them? I mean, I think I know the answer to that at the very top of the executive branch and maybe, you know, a level down. But what I'm curious about and potentially really frightened about is the extent to which that style of operating, thinking, and acting has sort of permeated down through the rank and file.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 5th, 2020. What if J. Edgar Hoover had been a moron? That's the question Lawfare's editor-in-chief Benjamin Wittes asks in a new article about his experience learning that his tweets had been written up in an intelligence report by the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Intelligence and Analysis. After reporting on an internal DHS document and publishing other documents to Twitter, Wittes learned that I&A had distributed intelligence reports about those tweets, along with the tweets of New York Times reporter Mike Baker. After Shane Harris reported on I&A's activities at the Washington Post, DHS announced that it was halting the practice of collecting information on journalists, and the head of the office was reassigned. It's a bizarre story, so we brought Wittes on the podcast, along with former Assistant Attorney General for National Security, David Criss, to discuss. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 5th. DHS compiles intelligence on journalists, including our editor-in-chief. So, Ben, you've had an eventful few weeks when it comes to your relationship with the Department of Homeland Security. So for listeners who are just tuning into this story now, can you start by giving a brief overview of what's been going on in your neck of the woods?
Sure. So back on July 20th, I received a document from a source at DHS Intelligence and Analysis that described DHS activity with respect to protesters, and specifically described authorized surveillance with respect to protesters in connection with important values like the protection of monuments. And Steve Vladek wrote about this document for Lawfare. And in response to that article, I started receiving other documents. And because these documents were, some of them were kind of small bore and not necessarily worth a full-fledged article themselves, I simply tweeted images of these documents on my Twitter feed. Unbeknownst to me, that became an issue for DHS INA, who began filing intelligence reports about my tweets. In total, they filed two of them, one for a tweet about a document complaining about the leaks and the other about a tweet disclosing a document concerning a nomenclature change regarding protesters. And I was unaware that I had become a DHS intelligence subject until Shane Harris of the Washington Post called me last week and informed me that he had and was intending to report on these two intelligence reports about me, along with an additional one about New York Times reporter Mike Baker.
And so you wrote a piece on Lawfare about this that opens by recalling a piece that you wrote very early on in the Trump presidency about the travel ban, which you called malevolence tempered by incompetence, and applying that to the current situation. So spell that out for me. Why is this malevolence tempered by incompetence?
So first of all, since you of all people are asking me this question, I should say that the phrase malevolence tempered by incompetence is an adaptation of a slightly longer phrase that you wrote in a text to me that the day that I wrote that article. And it's actually an adaptation of a Quinta Jurassicism. But look, I coined the phrase malevolence tempered by incompetence to describe the way the Trump administration has these horrible ideas and executes them so incompetently as to be, if not quite harmless, certainly much less harmful than they would be executed with a modicum of ability. And that's kind of what this this is an example of that. The idea that you're collecting public record information and treating as intelligence public record information about journalists doing journalism, and I am only sort of a journalist, but for this purpose, I am one. The function that I was playing here was very much that of a reporter. The idea that you're, you know, collecting and reporting on that as intelligence is really toxic stuff. The specific thing that they were collecting and reporting is laughably silly, which is to say they collected my tweet, which goes out to 400,000 Twitter followers, then that's before anybody clicks retweet, you know. They dressed up in kind of intelligence ease a tweet, and no competent intelligence professional would think that this has anything really to do with, you know, the task of gathering information that has anything to do with the protection of real homeland security. And so it's kind of goofy at the level at which it happened, but toxic at the level at which it was imagined.
So, David, you've worked in the Justice Department. You're very familiar with the laws and guidelines that govern intelligence community activity. From your perspective, is this malevolence tempered by incompetence?
It sure seems that way, or at least it's very hard to make sense of if you look at INA's procedures and try to square the circle of fitting this intelligence reporting into them. I mean, for one thing, there does not appear to me to be any reasonable belief or basis for reasonable belief that dissemination of Ben's tweets would assist the recipient of information about Ben in fulfilling one or more of the recipient's lawful intelligence, counterterrorism, law enforcement, or other homeland security related functions, which is the core language of the DHS guidelines around dissemination of this kind of information. I mean, there are some exceptions to that that allow for dissemination with higher approval. But again, the question would be, to what end? It just seems really weird and undisciplined. And I don't get it. If there's a joke here, I don't get it.
So let's talk about the specific agency that's at issue here, which is the DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis, IND&A. So Shane Harris wrote in his Washington Post piece, quote, "The Intelligence and Analysis Office has for years been the butt of jokes among larger, more established agencies like the CIA and FBI, who liken it to a team of junior varsity athletes.
That struck me as pretty harsh. David, I'm curious for your perspective. First off, just sort of where does INA fit in the intelligence community? And is that an accurate description of sort of how other agencies view it?
Well, it's the DHS intelligence entity that's part of the 17-member U.S. intelligence community, and it's created to handle intelligence and analysis for DHS, which is a gigantic, sprawling, you know, patchwork quilt of stuff put together by Congress after the 9/11 attacks. And in terms of the attitude of the other agencies towards INA, I would say that what Shane wrote is not inconsistent with what I have heard. I don't pretend for a moment to have a comprehensive or statistically reliable, you know, meaningful assessment of what the rest of the intelligence community thinks of them. But I have no basis to disagree with Shane's characterization and his reporting in that regard, I would say.
So, Ben, I wanted to talk a little bit about the specific document that sort of started all of this, which is this document that you and Steve reported on in Lawfare, as you mentioned, because I think that gets to some of the questions we're going to touch on about whether or not this is within INA's authorities, how broadly those authorities are being defined. So the memo, the headline of the piece was DHS authorizes domestic surveillance to protect statues and monuments. Can you just like walk us through what specifically this memo is and how much of a departure it is in your view from the kind of stuff that INA would usually be doing?
Well, what it is a document that purports to implement, at least it sort of purports to be implementing the president's executive order on monument protection that was issued back, I think, in May. It is a document that interprets the protection of federal property and monuments, whether they are federal or not, as a homeland security priority justifying surveillance, subject to the normal rules of DHS surveillance. So what it does is it basically articulates a new homeland security priority that can, when you're acting pursuant to it, be an adequate basis to justify collection of public record material on individuals. I thought this was a pretty extravagant understanding. When the president's executive order had been issued, a lot of people, including me, thought it was a kind of a do-nothing, you know, press release dressed up as an executive order. But here was DHS interpreting it as a, you know, as a basis actually to collect on people. So I was, you know, found it pretty surprising and a pretty significant departure from what I had thought of as DHS's core mission back when Congress created DHS. They were thinking of big homeland security problems like, you know, WMD terrorism and Al-Qaeda, right? And I don't think they were thinking of sort of local property crime. So I thought it was pretty surprising.
David, what curious for your thoughts on that memo.
I guess I kind of thought it was also mostly public relations. I mean, if you have a high pain tolerance, I wrote a long piece on Lawfare a while back on the CIA's internal guidelines for open source collection. And this can be compared against that baseline. It seems to me understandable and legitimate that if, you know, you're guarding federal facilities like a federal courthouse or some other facility, and you see on Twitter, hey, let's gather outside this courthouse, or let's all, you know, do an assault on DHS headquarters. Okay, guys, meet up at 7 p.m. You know, that's the kind of open source collection for the purpose of protecting a federal facility that you could imagine the government undertaking. And you could imagine, you know, beefing up protection or whatever they do in response to it. You can imagine disseminating as appropriate, depending on the nature of the target. This is just pretty far removed from that. I mean, the outset, just what are they protecting here? I don't say it's illegitimate to protect federal statues or monuments. I mean, the Washington Monument, for example. But, you know, then to go and pursue dissemination around somebody like Ben, you know, about whom we've all had our suspicions for a long time, but still he's a U.S. person and he's, you know, just responding to leaked, unclassified materials and disseminating that, I guess, even potentially as far afield as to the Five Eyes, although it's not clear to me whether it actually got to the Five Eyes or any other foreign partners. It just seems, I don't know, just bizarre. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. And that's putting aside the sort of internal materials themselves that came out suggesting that there may be some efforts to lean on the wheel and use certain vocabulary and characterize certain threats in certain ways. But just the idea that, like, Ben's tweets get circulated, I'm struggling for the hook. I suspect the Inspector General of DHS may struggle to find a hook in their proper purposes, in DHS's proper purposes. I guess they'll have some kind of leak theory, or maybe it's like this weird incitement theory. I don't know. I'm straining and I can't find a good way to make sense of this in the framework of their rules as I understand them.
Yeah, so I want to talk through the rules, but before we do that, I think it's important to sort of lay out what open source intelligence is and why, in your view, the Ben's tweets are not it, right? What, like, when an agency is collecting open source intelligence, what kind of stuff is it picking up? And what distinguishes that from, you know, a tweet that goes out to all of Ben's followers?
So the rules are detailed and exacting and complicated. And as I say, I mean, you know, wrote a very, very long piece on this about CIA, and DHS has fairly long procedures as well that were AG approved. They're publicly available on the internet if you want to go find them. And, you know, the first thing you've got to have, and it's really like the baseline requirement for all intelligence activity, particularly activity that affects Americans and involves U.S. persons under our system, is just a proper intelligence purpose. And so, as I say, I mean, you know, you can imagine getting open source information about, you know, efforts to incite a riot or attack a federal facility and, you know, blow it up or something. And, you know, that's one thing. There's obviously a lawful purpose to protect federal facilities. What's weird about Ben's situation is it's kind of one big step removed from that, which is it's reporting on somebody tweeting about a leak of unclassified material concerning how DHS characterizes certain activity in its own reporting. And, you know, this email from the head of the agency of the INA element, it's just very far removed from a proper purpose. And that's sort of the first and most essential basic element. If you don't have a proper intelligence purpose for something in the intelligence community, particularly if it involves U.S. persons, you shouldn't be doing it. And I just am not able to see it here. And, you know, the reason we have all these fancy guidelines and detailed procedures and requirements and that basic fundamental proper purpose requirement is because we have seen in our, well, Quinta, maybe not in your lifetime, but certainly in Ben and mine lifetimes, the radical abuse and politicization of our intelligence community and intelligence agencies, the pursuit of political intelligence to serve incumbents, and all kinds of really grotesque stuff. And it's from that terrible history that all these rules and requirements emerged. And that's why they're so important, because without them, you could find yourself, you know, slipping into a very, very dangerous kind of an environment. And so this whole idea of intelligence under law, it's wonderful for the lawyers. It's great, you know, and you have all these detailed procedures, which are a pain to have to read through. But they're there for a very basic reason, which is that the lessons of experience have taught us that if you don't have these kinds of restrictions, you can get into some very, very bad trouble very, very quickly. And our norms against that kind of thing and our rules against it, you know, have really only been in place since the mid-1970s. So it doesn't, you know, this is not a 200-year tradition. This is a relatively new And I worry sometimes a bit fragile tradition. So you have to take it very seriously when you have an apparent departure from such a baseline requirement as having a proper intelligence purpose.
Ben, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I will just add to it that the list of proper intelligence purposes is spelled out with some precision in the DHS guidelines on this sort of collection. And I think it's actually worth going through the list of all of the general mission set categories that can justify surveillance, because I think it gives you an idea of how far from that this, at least superficially, appears to be. So there are two broad categories of DHS mission that can justify domestic collection. One is what are called national missions, and the other are departmental missions. So the national missions are A, international terrorism threats, B, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, C, intelligence activities directed against the United States, 4, international criminal drug activities, and lastly, other hostile activities directed against the United States by foreign powers, organizations, persons, or their agents. So none of those is even like within 100 miles of collecting my tweet, powerful and important, though I flatter myself that I am. So then the second category is these what are called departmental missions. And they include domestic terrorism threats. Again, there's no plausible domestic terrorism threat that, you know, collecting my tweet is going to protect against. Threats to critical infrastructure and key resources. Now, I suppose you could say that, you know, this is about protecting federal property, and so those are kind of key resources. The problem with that is, again, that's not what the tweets are about. The tweets are not about any such threat. They're actually about DHS information control. And so even if I were tweeting about, you know, hey, I think people are going to, you know, blow up this statue, then, you know, you'd be plausibly within that zone. But here, I don't think you are. C, significant threats to the nation's economic security, public health, or public safety, including but not limited to local manifestations of national threats, local outbreaks of diseases reasonably likely to pose the risk of becoming a national pandemic. I don't think that one's plausible. D, major disasters and other catastrophic acts. And E, any other threat of such severity and magnitude that effective response would be beyond any of the affected state and local governments, such that federal assistance would be necessary. Well, again, you know, this is not plausibly within any of those ambits, in my judgment. So those are the listed bases. Now, to this, you can add, based on the memo that Steve and I wrote about, you could add protection of, you know, monuments, even privately held monuments, but no DHS officer or any other state, local, or tribal or foreign government is going to be in a better position to protect a monument or a federal building because they are aware of the DHS documents that I made public. And so I think the whole thing as pertains to me is kind of comical, but the first major point that I really agree with David about is that, you know, they should not be collecting at all anything about anybody unless it is reasonably tied to one of those mission sets. And, you know, that is just not obvious. We're not obviously within 10 miles of that in this situation.
Yeah, so that gets to my next question. So if I wanted to play devil's advocate, right, I could say, you know, okay, they collected Ben's tweets. You know, he said in the piece that he's not scared and he's not going to stop tweeting. this doesn't seem to be a particularly big problem for him. Like, so what? Like, what's the big deal, right? So spell that out for me a little more. Ben and David, I'm curious for both of your thoughts. Like, why is this concerning on a broader scale?
You know, look, I think Ben's right. Who cares about Ben to begin with? I've read on Twitter that he's a very bad man. So I guess at that, we don't have to worry. But he's well-resourced and he's, you know, reasonably well-protected and so forth and so on. So I sort of agree, Ben, with your assessment that the issue here is not you. It's almost perversely sort of probably, you know, for somebody like you, an opportunity to try to educate the public about these issues. So I'd much rather have them do this about you than about some ordinary person without as many resources, without as much expertise and so forth, without the same kind of platform. The spooky thing about it, I think, is, as you've said, who's next? And what kind of interim or chilling effect, you know, does this kind of thing have on people, at least once it becomes known? And also, harking back to what I was saying before, what does it tell you about the way in which people in this intelligence element are thinking about their mission and about what's appropriate and how they're supposed to apply their rules and what it means to operate within a framework of intelligence under law? Again, I just don't see how you disseminate this to these entities on the belief that it's in keeping with their recipient's mission statement. And so either somebody just got that wrong. Okay, people make mistakes, but, you know, why did they get it wrong? Did they even ask the question, or did they just do it because they were getting pressure from above? You know, what's the tone at the top in this agency? How are they thinking about intelligence under law? Do they know the history? Do they know the reason that these complicated, detailed rules apply to them? So I think Ben is Ben and he'll be fine. But for others, this is more of a concern. And as a symptom of a mindset within this agency, I am concerned about it and would want to understand. You know, I used to be the compliance officer for a Fortune 50 company. Like, what's the culture of compliance? What's the understanding in the rank and file of how you're supposed to do your job? And how important do they think it is to operate in a framework of intelligence under law and to follow the rules even where it's a nuisance or where it may be limiting for them? Do they have a regular practice of consulting with their lawyers? You know, do they just sort of look to the bosses, and what tone at the top are the bosses setting for them? I mean, I think I know the answer to that at the very top of the executive branch and maybe, you know, a level down. But what I'm curious about and potentially really frightened about is the extent to which that style of operating, thinking, and acting has sort of permeated down through the rank and file. Because those folks, you know, in the so-called deep state, who are supposed to, you know, hold the line on these core values and the rules and procedures, I mean, if they've been compromised by this and it's a symptom of something larger, that's of grave concern. Because as I said, this paradigm of intelligence under law, it's relatively new, it's relatively fragile, and it's vitally important.
So I would just add a couple of things to that. One encouraging and one not. The encouraging one is that I actually think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about the ground level. These documents leaked very fast. And the reason they leaked very fast is that the culture at the ground level is pretty strong. And people are, at the non-political levels, are appalled by what's been going on with INA, what they've been asked to do. And I actually came away, I'm not sure I've gone away yet, but I have a lot of respect for the integrity of a lot of the people involved. And I think one of the reasons, the reason that we have an INA scandal on our hands and that the leader of the office has been removed and that there's going to be an IG investigation and that Adam Schiff knows enough to do the investigation he's going to do, The reason is that a whole lot of people have exactly the same values that David just described. And I think that's actually pretty encouraging. Here's the not encouraging side. The danger here, as David says, is not about me. And I actually don't think journalists love when journalism is under attack, or that's a story that moves journalists a great deal for obvious reasons. I don't think the principal threat here is to journalism. I think the principal threat is to protesters. And, you know, the right to protest is no less First Amendment protected than the right to do journalism. It's the same First Amendment, different clause, but you know, it's the same basic idea. And, you know, I am as David says, in a relatively privileged position. There aren't that many people who have a platform of their own, actually two between the Twitter feed and Lawfare itself, who have a network of sources all over the intelligence bureaucracy. In this case, one of whom decided to feed stuff to my good friend Shane Harris that was alarming about me, you know, that the government was doing. Now, you know, that's a pretty unusual set of conditions to exist. And in addition, I have, you know, a lot of lawyers who are potentially at my disposal to assert whatever legal rights I need to assert. So if you think about the Black Lives Matter activist in Portland, Oregon, or the proverbial mom in the Wall of Moms, she doesn't have that at any of those things. And if DHS is collecting on her as inappropriately as it was collecting on me, she is very unlikely to find out about it. And if she finds out about it, it is not obvious to me that she has the ease that I do of doing something about it, including, you know, from just exposing it to talking about it on podcasts to potentially bringing a lawsuit to get some redress. And so I do worry that what we've seen here is the tip of the iceberg, and the tip is journalists, but the iceberg is surveillance of the protesters themselves. And that's my concern. And I also am concerned about what is being collected. So in this case, what was being collected is my tweet, which I'm thrilled for anybody to read. And I think it's great if government officials want to collect my tweets and study them carefully and write reports on them that are many times longer than the tweets themselves. But if it's okay to collect that, why isn't it okay to collect 500 or 600 public record documents about me and create, you know, some kind of a dossier based on public record information on me or on this hypothetical protester? And for that matter, why isn't it okay to add to that dossier a whole lot of data that you might buy from Equifax or from some other data broker? I can't really see a reason why, if one of those is okay, the other is not. And so I'm concerned both about who is being targeted, but also about what sort of information is being created about them and what sort of amalgamations of information. And, you know, I'll have to see the next time I apply for a visa to go to New Zealand whether I'm allowed to get into the country. But I suspect, you know, it wouldn't take a whole lot of intelligence reports to Five Eyes countries before maybe your local Black Lives Matter activist would have, if he or she is interested in traveling internationally, maybe a little bit more trouble traveling internationally than she deserves.
So one of the odd and interesting parts of this story is, obviously, we've discussed it's sort of part of a bigger story about Trump's use of DHS to sort of come into Portland and stir up mayhem in the name of law and order. A lot of the historical analogies to this, I mean, Ben, your piece ask the question, what if J. Edgar Hoover had been an idiot? Come not from DHS, obviously, because DHS is a relatively young agency, but from the FBI, from the CIA. And I think it's worth dwelling a little bit here on the fact that it's DHS that we're talking about. It's not the FBI, for example, and that even though the FBI might be the agency that people think of when they think of, you know, the long arm of the government, given Hoover's use of the Bureau to surveil activists in the 50s and 60s, Trump is bearing down through the Department of Homeland Security. We've talked about this on other podcasts, but I did want to make that point here and ask both of you, to what extent is this a DHS-specific problem in your view? To what extent is it sort of that DHS is new, it's an unformed culture, it's run by an acting secretary, and to what extent is this something that we should worry about spreading to the other agencies as well?
I mean, I think it's fair to say that that President Trump has a ambivalent relationship with the FBI, in part because of its role in foreign intelligence and FISA collection, which he has said at various times was, you know, targeting him or whatever. So I think that's one factor here. Number two, I think the FBI does have pretty strong traditions of rule of law and following rules and procedures and taking kind of the long view on things. You know, they've held the line in the past on interrogation. And I have a sense that Chris Wray wants to be careful about that and that that may be an appropriate tone that he's setting there. I know Chris and I think well of him overall. So, you know, it may be, as you were saying, Quinta, you know, DHS is led up and down by acting officials. It is a younger, newer agency. Some of the people who do law enforcement for DHS are used to interacting, you know, not with U.S. persons on a daily basis. So, you know, there are some reasons, cultural, historical, personnel, that may be behind this, this use of DHS personnel. You know, having said that, I do think that there is reason to be concerned across the board about the extent to which the tone at the top has trickled down. I share Ben's optimism about this particular incident and what it reveals. And I know from direct experience that there are lots of really solid, patriotic, freedom-loving, you know, rule-following Boy Scout and Girl Scout types in the IC. And I think they can be trusted to hold the line. But I also think that they've been under pressure and the system's been under pressure. And I think, you know, if Biden wins the election, I think his transition team is going to come in and is going to need to deal with this and the psychology that all of this has created. And they're going to need to treat it as a real thing. They may not want to overemphasize it, but they are going to have to deal with it. And I hope that when they, you know, really get through there and look at it, they will find that many of the institutions held almost all of the time in almost all of the agencies. But I'm pretty sure they're going to find some real pockets of distortion or departure from rules, and that's very bad.
Yeah, I basically agree with that. I don't see outside of DHS a great deal of evidence in law enforcement, operational law enforcement agencies, of the same sort of problems that we're seeing in DHS. So on the intelligence side, we haven't seen any CIA scandals over the last few years. We haven't seen any NSA scandals, which is, you know, I think where a lot of people expected to see them, given the Snowden stuff. There was a lot of concern when Trump came in that we were going to have, you know, out of control drone strikes and, the NSA collecting everything domestically. And we have not seen profound changes, much less politically driven changes in the broader intelligence conduct of the intelligence community. I think that is generally true of the FBI. The issues that as well, and I think actually the FBI has been where some of the most active confrontation between the intelligence community and the White House has happened. And, you know, similarly, we have not seen a lot of allegations of FBI misconduct outside of the sort of normal case-specific stuff that you always see. You know, a given case goes awry and some people do something wrong or screw something up. That happens. You know, where we have seen problems, of course, is at the Justice Department, although importantly, it is at the senior political levels of the Justice Department. And we do seem to have a real problem at DHS, and that problem implicates both their law enforcement components and their intelligence components. And so I do think it is a generally encouraging picture that the you know, we have not seen widespread corruption of the law enforcement and intelligence apparatuses of the country. That said, we have seen a series of problems that need to be taken very seriously. And, you know, just as when the Inspector General of the Justice Department revealed problems with the FISA process in the Carter Page matter, you look at that and you say, okay, Devin Nunes may be a stop clock, but a stop clock is right twice a day. And, you know, there were problems in this case, and we need to take that seriously. I do think you need to take, you know, the fact that INA is collecting apparently improperly on one person or two people, i.e. Mike Baker and me, and we have reason to think on a whole bunch of people who are protesting. And the fact that, you know, there do seem to be some unmarked vans in Portland that are, you know, in contain people in camo gear who are inviting people in for a conversation to an unmarked van without identifying themselves as law enforcement officers. Yeah, you know, that's a real problem, and that we need to get to the bottom of what the scope of the law enforcement and intelligence activity was and who's responsible for it and under what legal authority they thought they were doing it.
So let's talk about inspectors general and also Congress and other ways to address this. I believe the DHS inspector general has opened an investigation into the department's activities in Portland, although I don't think INA specifically. And Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee of the House Intelligence Committee, has sent a letter to acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf requesting information on the activities that we've been describing here. So, what do both of you think the mechanisms are for addressing these problems? From what we just described, it certainly doesn't seem like an Inspector General report is going to be sufficient. But from Adam Schiff's perspective, is the right answer to hold hearings, try to get Chad Wolf in front of him? To what extent is this something that can be addressed through these mechanisms that we have now? And to what extent is this something that really is going to need a change of administration to be tackled?
You know, inspectors general and congressional oversight are probably the two main vehicles for short and medium term addressing of this kind of a thing. You know, there's also journalism that may shed some light on things, and there are other mechanisms, but those are two of the big ones. Intelligence oversight has, you know, had a lot of problems, particularly on the House side recently, both under Chairman Nunes, and I think it's still in difficulty under Chairman Schiff. It's very divided and very partisan, and I think it can be done well or badly, you know, depending, and I don't know how it will be done here. I hope it will be done with an eye towards really getting at the essential adherence to rule of law requirements and the procedures and not turned into a circus, but, you know, it might be. And that's not to say that they shouldn't publicize it. On the contrary, that's part of their role. But there are ways to do it that are more or less partisan in approach and more or less serious. I think on the inspector general side, I actually don't know who the inspector general is of DHS, but I'll assume that there will be a competent investigation and report. And depending on what's found, and I, by the way, assume that the investigation into Portland will cover Ben's situation. And, depending on what's found, it may give rise to further investigations. I mean, sort of the same way in which Mike Horowitz at DOJ, the inspector general there, found serious, serious problems that I've written about separately in the Carter Page FISAs, and then as a result undertook a review of a number of other FISA applications and issued some preliminary findings on that, to which DOJ responded very recently, saying maybe the problems aren't that bad, although some of the problems are not so great, like not having a Woods file, can't be undone. But in other words, what the inspector general finds will give rise to possible further review, and hopefully they will have an eye towards these broad themes of like acting with a proper intelligence purpose, fostering a culture of adherence to rule of law and following the rules. I think personally that a lot of the problems that we're seeing, a lot of the cultural pressure to deviate comes from the top and from President Trump in particular and his closest political allies and advisors and subordinates. And so I do think that there's reason to believe that if there were an election and Biden wins, that you would have a much higher return to normalcy. But in the meantime, and if Trump wins a second term, you do have these existing mechanisms, congressional oversight, inspectors general, chief among them, to ferret out and get to things. They're not perfect. No system is perfect, but they have in the past produced some important information and fostered some significant reforms.
Yeah, I will give a slightly less optimistic view of this. I don't think anything's going to happen without a change of administration. The congressional oversight process, which is very important, is at most a remedial matter. And the inspector general process in other agencies has been sort of trampled on. Both of these are very important processes, but they are responsive processes, they are not going to be the thing that the most they can do is hold back a tide or slow it down. As long as Donald Trump is in office and wants DHS to be rounding up people, building walls, holding kids in cages, and beating up on protesters, that's going to happen. And, the question is, how much can you minimize it? And how much redress can you get for it? Not can you put DHS on a solid and responsible course? And I think, realistically, you are talking about a change in administration. And the installation of a Secretary of Homeland Security who actually cares how the agency behaves across a wide range of areas. And, I do think in a new administration, you are going to have serious thought to whether the creation of the Department of Homeland Security was a mistake and the government should be organized in a somewhat different fashion.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, right, is what this says about the existence of DHS itself. I mean, David, I'm curious for your thoughts there. Does this further undermine the case for DHS in your view?
I mean, I think a lot of people have had a lot of doubts about DHS from before it was created and the advisability of putting together all of these disparate components. I've seen the difficulty of that kind of corporate merger in the private sector because I worked for Time Warner shortly after the AOL Time Warner merger. And I've seen it in government in various ways. And I think those challenges have been there from the beginning. Broadly speaking, that is developing a unified culture and identity and bringing all these components together. And I think Kerry Cordero has done some very good work recently, sort of going through it and documenting things that are problematic. I don't know whether anybody really has the stomach to pull it apart, because that will no doubt produce further disruption and organizational mayhem, at least in the short term. But you certainly have the feeling that I do, at least, and I think many do in the intelligence community, to sort of riff off what you said about Shane's reporting earlier, that DHS just needs a lot of work to get itself organized. It's a gigantic, sprawling agency with a very wide-ranging set of missions. And it hasn't, I think, come together in the way that optimists hoped for. And it has been, I think, more in keeping with pessimistic predictions from the beginning. It needs some real work. And the work is not glamorous. It's not, headline grabbing. It's kind of putting together the plumbing and the infrastructure and the sort of back office elements that make the thing cohere as an agency. That is not the kind of work that people typically appointed as cabinet secretaries like to do or feel that they will be rewarded for doing. But I think it needs to be done if the agency is to survive and fulfill its mandate.
Yeah, I think the argument for the Department of Homeland Security was never very good. And interestingly, the department was, largely the brainchild of two senators, both of whom are somewhat discredited at this point. And so I wonder actually if it will have as strong a political constituency as it has in the past. But look, the argument that immigration issues and the Secret Service and the Coast Guard should all be in the, and FEMA should all be in the same agency is pretty illogical. And there's not a lot of organizational coherence to it. The department has had at least two superb secretaries in Janet Napolitano and Michael Chertoff, both of whom are very serious, able people who have who are kind of diversely accomplished. And no one's really been able to make it work well. And, I think that's a pretty good argument for the idea that the department, which was created in an effort to bring organizational coherence to all things that related to the protection of the homeland, in fact failed to do that. And the argument for thinking about whether, maybe there is a different way to do that is pretty good. Now, in the middle of a global pandemic and an economic collapse with big policy questions like climate change and confronting China and economic inequality on the table, how high up the priority list is this? I would not argue that this is a year one item for a Biden administration, but I do think the task of making this agency work may be impossible, and figuring out which components of it actually should belong in a smaller agency and which should go somewhere else, why the Coast Guard is not part of the Defense Department has always been opaque to me, frankly. Which components can go somewhere else, which ones can, are in fact thematically coherent enough to be part of a single agency, and how you would organize that strike me as a very good question for very smart people like Harry Cordero to be spending time on now, because eventually we're going to decide that this experiment doesn't work.
All right. On that note, forward looking, David Chris, enemy of the state, Ben Wittes, thanks for joining us.
Outstanding. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our audio engineer is Zachary Frank. And our producer is Jen Padja Howell. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.